Okay, I've been asked to chair this session, which means keeping the speakers on time. I'll do that the same way as we did this morning. Let me introduce the first speaker today, Jay Norris, talking about the nitty-gritty now, all the observations and the data on the gamma ray burst, soft gamma ray repeaters, time histories, and correlations.
So I've been asked to cover too much material, so I'm only going to talk about recent developments, or mostly recent developments. The first gamma ray burst outline, I want to discuss develop the observational relationship between the pulse paradigm and the Lorentz factor, that is, spectral lags may appear to indicate observed luminosity, but of course there's all the dirtiness of the data that you have to deal with. And I'll show three bursts that are relevant to this, not just because they're the most famous and brightest and longest, but because they're interesting things about these extrema. And then I'll go into some of the miscellaneous gamma ray burst statistics that have been put forward lately, including the no high energy emission class, which is attributable to brightness bias, and just show shortly a peak flux computation problem or calibration, and look at the duration distribution, which is clearly still only bimodal, and then look at some of Ali Kronauten's results on extended gamma ray tails. Also, just briefly revisit the 1998 BW April 25th, 98 connection there, which was a single pulse type burst. And then I'll talk about what everybody's always asking me, is time dilation real, and really how hard it is to measure. And for SGRs, I couldn't really improve upon David Palmer's LEAH seminar, which occurred about a month ago, in which he introduces the idea of independent relaxation systems that may be going on simultaneously and giving rise to the trends in delta T's between bursts. And they also look at some of the latest data from SGR 1900 plus 14, the super bursts and large bursts and phase grams. So 1996, even before, and for a while, this is where we've been in terms of understanding what pulses do. That is, pulses either range from being relatively narrow and symmetric and even aligned, except this is an extremum that is never really quite reached, to being broader with the peak lagging at lower energy. In fact, perhaps 90% of pulses, not just within a burst, but within many bursts, fit in this range. Now, the blue is high energy and the red is low energy. And the thing I recognized back then is this might have something to do with beaming and the broadness of the region that you're looking at. But the external shock models were in vogue back then, and the time scales were just too long. It didn't make any sense. So I put that idea away for a while, and time dilation came along to kind of keep me occupied. But as everybody is familiar with by now, by reading Sari and Perron and Fenimore and colleagues' treatments, if you look at the time delay, you get this expression where this is coming from off the line of sight, and this is coming from on the line of sight, and as Ed Fenimore has pointed out, and I think everybody appreciates, off the line of sight is going to be softer photons, and more on the line of sight is going to be harder photons. So, in fact, that's what we used to see. On the left side there, you see hardness ratio, and you see open and closed points. The filled points are better determinations. And then you see the lag of the centroid from the high energy to the low energy. On the right side, you see a rise to decay ratio. And because I didn't see any trend here, I thought perhaps something was wrong. But probably what was wrong was that the rise to the decay ratio isn't important, but rather the width of the pulse is important. And also, pulses within a burst aren't the only thing that's going on in terms of spectral evolution. The burst tends to evolve and get softer overall, but the pulses individually also evolve. And so this is the geometry that is described on the equation on the previous slide there, and here's a reduction here. The opening angle is relatively small, so this is about a milliradian or so for a gamma of 1,000. And you just are getting this Doppler boost in between some portion of the wavefront that lags behind and the leading edge. And so when the January 23 burst occurred, I looked at it, but at relatively low resolution, and immediately thought, well, there it is. There are really two wide pulses. Something's the matter, so I'm not going to pursue this any further. Having looked at the three previous bursts and saw that their lags were interesting, this is the one as elucidated in Kulkarni et al. That has the breaks and has the very high total isotropic energy required. And so when I read that paper, I got out the time profiles and looked at them very carefully, and I could see that there was really no lag by eye. And so I started doing these cross-correlation analyses between different energy channels. And there's really only a set of about six bursts that are usable in some fashion, six on the left, four on the right. The ones on the left, you see two different lags between channel 1 and channel 4, which gives you a larger lag. Channel 1 and channel 3 gives you a better determination because of statistics. And what you see is, as in Svi Karan's talk, the expectation is somewhat fulfilled. So the bursts that have higher energy have shorter lag. Now this is gamma to X-ray peak flux, somewhat a measure of beaming factor, whereas on the right-hand side, I've plotted isotropic total energy divided by 10 to the 52 ergs. I should say also on the right side, time dilation is taken out, but not spectral redshift. This just wasn't enough time to get into looking at 16-channel data. And so then here the bursts that show spectral evolution within a pulse, and they have a relatively large lag, and here are the ones that don't really. The clear outlier in this above graph here is 980329, and its lags between channel 1 and 3 compared to channel 1 and channel 4 just don't quite agree. It's a very odd-looking burst. The only saving grace for that guy would be as if, in fact, he were at a redshift of 5, and then we could have plotted him closer to the axis over here. Now, the three different determinations that you see with the different symbols just have to do with how much of the burst down to what peak intensity level was included in the cross-correlation, down to the 10% level, 30%, or 50% level. I was doing all this before I read Ed's latest papers. He had been telling me about how bursts looked to be effectively self-similar, and so then I went and read the papers, and I saw surely I should be able to utilize the entire time profile. Because he'd shown this using autocorrelations of different pieces of the events and also looking at our pulse fits from way back when. But as a matter of fact, you really can't depend on that for the lag between channel 1 and channel 4 so very much, because as you get way far out to the 10% level for the total intensity out to 25 keV, the noise really starts to dominate for channel 4. So channel 3 to 1 lag is much more dependable. So I wanted to just go off and write that up, but Jerry Bonnell advised me we should go back and look again at that question of what's going on, at least in the brightest verse, and see, even though there are other extrinsic effects convolved in on the abscissa, both time dilation and redshift are going to be convolved in. On the ordinate, redshift and distance are going to be convolved in, at least for peak flux, but maybe not for hardness ratio. You're just going to have redshift. So we went and did the lags for the brightest bursts where you could still see reasonable channel 4 emission, not all the way across the burst, of course, because it fades out. But we did these lags 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 as well. I've circled a couple of points on here as interesting outliers that we'll see in a second what they are or what this green one is. The blue one, the blue one still stays there in a few slides from now. That's the January 23rd verse of this year. And this point right here is the most intense burst observed by Batsy. So let me just show you that guy. It's just that you need to expand or compress in order to see the outliers down here at low hardness ratio. Okay, so this goes from minus 0.2 to 1, this goes from minus 1 to 3, and you just pick up these additional further points out here. So visually, obviously, what's going on here is the preponderance of lags, as discovered by Band in 97, is near 100 milliseconds, and so the population congregates around here rather than at large lags. I think this has been remarked upon by many people. It used to be thought, I don't know exactly how this myth got propagated, but maybe it was by me, that bursts all show hard and soft spectral evolution, and it's really clear to see. But it's not really clear to see. It's hard to find. I think the best demonstration of it was in Band. In fact, the reason it's hard to see is because the time scale is usually short. So if, in fact, this is a paradigm that relates to Lorentz factor, then the distribution of luminosities would be peaked on the high end rather than on the low end. Right, to get back to this point here in green, sorry, just to show you another bunch of them here. This is the lag from channel 1 to channel 4. Those were channel 1 to channel 3. And it's a similar situation. When you have a wider range in between channel, here's 3 to 2, here's 4 to 1. When there's a wider range, you get a larger lag, a better demonstration of the effect. But of course, with all the extrinsic problems involved in not knowing what those burst redshifts are. So here's that brightest burst, trigger 5614. It's 250,000 counts per second, and that's in channel 3. It's not all four of them added together. Here's channel 4, blue, channel 1, red, channel 2, yellow. And what you see here is the blue and green and yellow and red peaks all ought to have lined up. You ought to have seen the shifting of the peak here. But instead, you got a negative lag. And the reason is that the first pulse that's here in channel 1 and channel 2 is missing in channel 4 and channel 3. And that's just entirely unusual, except that this is an extremely bright burst. And so the only explanation is that the high energy could not break out during that intense phase, as far as I can see. And somewhat of a corroboration of that is that the pulse that triggered the experiment is shown here, where I've blown things up by a factor of 100 or so. And you can in fact see that this burst was showing the typical spectral evolution. Just something here was so bright it knocked out the high energy emission. So there are anomalies left and right to be worried about, and you just can't go interpreting the data and being sure what's going on. It's just another little detail about dealing with it. Here's peak flux on the ordinate in the same lags as plotted before, 1 to 4, 3 to 1, and the only difference between the right and left, again, is just an expansion of the time axis, so you can see the outliers. And there's that brightest burst of all, but he should have been over here once I calculated the lag. Okay, and but in hardness ratio, in the previous diagrams, he would have been down here. So he would have been commensurate in hardness ratio. The only problem being, must be a really close burst to be this bright. So, also see here the preponderance of lags are a little bit shy of 100 milliseconds for bright bursts, but they tend to congregate a little bit more closely or a little bit more spread out for the dimmer bursts. I had to analyze the data for the dimmer half by binning up by a factor of 2. And also I noticed that there tended to be a little bit less reliability. So I think there's just some spread. There's larger error for these dimmer bursts. So that's probably what's going on. Okay, and so the same kind of paradigm is seen for short bursts, for which we have very little absolute information. These are long bursts, these are short bursts. There's a difference in time scale of a factor of 20. Otherwise, you sort of see this filled in diagram here of, and now again I've plotted rise to decay ratio. The determinations are much better for short bursts, which have fewer pulses that tend to be more isolated, and you get better fits, whereas the pulses in long bursts tend to be much more overlapping. The fact that there's about a factor of 20 in pulse width between the two is interesting, but the fact that they also display this range of rise to decay ratio that is very similar to that seen in long bursts as well. So, summary of that situation is, we seem to see something that is very much like what is predicted by theory for the central engine type scales, 10 to the 17 centimeters, the lags corresponding to gammas of 1,000 and 100 are pretty much dead on with the extrema predicted and observed. Okay, question is whether or not you're ever going to be able to deconvolve out these extrinsic effects and see whether or not, if there is something to be seen, of a cleaner relationship between isotropic energy, luminosity, and intrinsic lag. But that's something we'll go try to figure out. Short bursts, they look like long bursts. And if I showed you some short bursts and added noise, you wouldn't be able to tell until you looked for a while. You could see, in fact, they have far fewer pulses. Are they more strongly beamed? It's an interesting question. In a second, I'll show you Valerie Conantin's work where the gamma ray tails, extended gamma ray tails extending for hundreds of seconds, just don't appear in her average ensemble. It makes me wonder whether or not we will ever see optical counterparts for short bursts. There's a remaining mystery in my mind, and that is why the multiplicity, why the high multiplicity of narrow pulses, or why so few broad pulses in these ones that would appear to have lower gammas. So here's one of the four bursts I'm going to show you today. I can't remember the date for it, but this is the one that went on for more than an orbit. And in fact, we didn't include this in our analysis of the single pulse set because we just couldn't fit the background. But Valerie was able to do that by looking at the backgrounds of preceding orbits, several orbits in the day preceding and following the event. And so just don't pay any attention to the zero marks here because I didn't actually have a good background to fit. This is a long single pulse event. So you might think that this represents, in fact, it does represent the extreme of this paradigm. And the fits are merely my attempts to unconvince myself that a log normal pulse is a good thing. In fact, you can see residuals right here on the peak at high energy, and then all across here in channel 1 at low energy, and at the peaks. So this burst is, this single pulse is, you know, 100 times longer than most long pulses. This is clearly representing the extreme. These are Valerie's results here. And I think, let's see, I think some of this was shown in Paris. It's a little bit small to look at. So if you go around clockwise, starting in the upper left, what you see is 100 gamma ray bursts for which there were no gaps, for which she could go off and get the backgrounds and see what was happening over several orbits. And then again, the colors are, red is 25 to 50 keV, and blue is 300 keV and above. Then you go to the 40 longest bursts, but they're still pretty long, and she has taken subsets of these. So the effect persists. It's not just a few bursts that are giving rise to this tail that is coming down here. And then you see the red points lying above out here for hundreds of seconds. And then these are the medium, less than 20 seconds, but still greater than 2 seconds in duration. And you can see the hint of something coming down here, and you can see the preponderance of the error bars for the low energy channel still persisting. And these are the short bursts, less than 2 seconds. There are 20 of those. And it seems to be that you can still see more red points above than below zero. The error bars, however, are about 3 or 4 times larger than the error bars up here. It's hard to see with these small graphs. So
the red colors, the channel?
The red is the lowest energy LAD channel, 25 to 50 keV, and the blue is 300 keV and above. So even in the 50 to 100 keV band, the yellow band here, you can see that this effect was extending out to on the order of 500 seconds at least. She's still worrying about the systematics of this calibration. Okay, that's subject number 1, and this is number 2. So there was a looking for dichotomies. Pizzichini and Cavelli 02 and Belli and Pendleton, many people have looked and seen that if you consider those bursts that don't have any high energy emission above 300 keV, then plot their log n log p, a game that has been played forever, then you get this solid line here. Now, it immediately impressed me when Graziella saw this, that it's probably a brightness bias involved with redshift. So we eventually got around doing this, and we just plain haven't written the discussion yet. There's not much to write, but this will come out pretty soon. It's Bonnell and Norris. Then what you do is you just take bright bursts, you compensate for their brightness, scaling them down, adding noise, and redshifting according to these two different band spectra and broken power law. And whereas it looks like there's a dearth there on the bright end, it's something that we could monkey with, but we didn't want to, because that would just sort of say we were monkeying with it. Instead, if you look at it in a differential plot, you can see that the observed distribution is bracketed, except right up here in the counts of just a few bright bursts. And so we claim that this is just a brightness bias, but this is just the distribution of bursts that are this way. They're dim. Now, the other half of the paradigm was, according to Pendleton, if you went and took bright bursts and then looked for those regions in the burst where there was no high energy emission and took those peak fluxes and plotted a log n log p for that, then you would also see this apparent beaming situation. But that, in fact, is an exact tautology. That is, if you want to go derive the log n log p minus 3/2 law, you don't have to look for the presence of a quantity. You can also look for the absence of it. And so I don't think there's anything there. So just very quickly, there were this is a sample from a ways back. That's the duration distribution in our attempt to make a signal-to-noise equalized, albeit shorter durations for long bursts because you've dimmed them down. And I'll get back to that point in a second. You can see how our blue curve is shifted to shorter times. But the salient point I'm getting at right here is there's a valley here, and there's nothing, there's no third peak, there's no interjacent third peak. And we don't measure short bursts very well because we did all this at 64 millisecond resolution. The 3B catalog, I think, has much better determinations because we were attempting to do this on a uniform time scale. But the Mukherjee and et al. Analysis in a large number of dimensions was looking and seeing that there was a class in here, this little knot. When you look at it in terms of duration versus hardness ratio, it didn't exactly matter which hardness ratio you pick. And so, you know, the question is whether or not that's there if you make different measurements. And there you can see there's this interjacent peak, and it was pretty obvious in the 3B set from a while back. But in fact, there are more bursts now. It's not quite as obvious. And here's that knot blown up. And if you use our durations, same hardness ratios, just kind of blown up onto the same scale, looking for that knot in the middle, I don't see it. You can claim that it's necessary to look in a higher number of dimensions to see something, but if you can't see it, for me, it ain't there. So I won't worry about it anymore. And just a slight remark about the use of peak fluxes is we started calibrating our own peak fluxes and using Pendleton method, and fairly well able to reproduce them. That's the ratio on the ordinate over here. The big gap is when SGR 1806 was active, I guess, taking up all the trigger space. This is trigger number here. And so we get about a ratio of unity with some spread, but this is prior to the end of 1B. So the 1B catalog has a larger spread. That's still out there on the web. It's just something to be aware of. A different algorithm was utilized to calculate those peak fluxes. How am I doing? I'll be able to get to SGRs, I guess so. So there was a burst that was a single pulse dim burst that happened excruciatingly close in time to when a supernova happened. You know, a few weeks after that, there were three flares on the sun simultaneously, and you know, it was an incredible thing. They weren't causally related, but the chance probability was 10 to the minus 5. So. Okay, made my point. Anyway, there were a couple of salient things, or apparently salient. This was a no high energy emission burst, but it was just dim, and that's why you didn't see it. And it was your usual evolution of this single pulse here. Okay, so there was a Bloom et al. Article saying, well, maybe that's what they are. Those are the ones that are associated with supernova. And you know, that's the distribution of matter in nearby space, okay, and so that's where you're going to be seeing these particular supernova from. That's out to about 100 megaparsecs, and that's this, you know, translate that into the supergalactic plane. And sure enough, the ones that had been searched for, and in fact, I guess all of those that are type 1B or type C in the IUC supernova catalog, if you plot them, there's about a 2 sigma tendency to congregate towards the supergalactic plane. And so we sort of meticulously went through and looked for those single pulse events. Come to think of it now, we might have expanded to two pulse type events that are relatively long, but didn't think of that then. And we really narrowed this down. We only used those bursts that had fairly small residuals, and that's the distribution there, and the symbols apply to different characterizations, relatively bright, relatively dim, high residuals, low residuals. And for each of these different groups, there's no tendency to congregate towards the supergalactic plane. And I think that's about all we're ever going to be able to say about this, because the event rate is so excruciatingly low for these single pulse events. And GRO isn't going to live that much longer. So that brings me to measurement of time stretching or time dilation. This other work just keeps getting in the way of finishing this off. This is from a ways back. This is the actual measured trend of peak flux versus time stretching for the peak alignment and method, where the fiducial is this group here of about 92 bright bursts. Now, one point that is important to keep in mind, so we shifted from using durations to using this peak alignment method because, in fact, it produces smaller error bars. And so you get off to somewhat of a jump here. If you divide this class in half equally, you don't get any jump from the brightest to the second brightest. But after that, you get off to a jump. At this point here, VATSI is about 98% complete. So something's going on. And the question is, what is it? So this was shown previously in Paris by Bob Nemiroff, and this is his Monte Carloing of the situation, assuming a 0.3, 0.7 omega m, omega lambda universe, and a standard candle, in which he was almost able to reproduce the results. Of course, below 1, you start to be not complete, and those last 3 points I have really kind of rigged. I have attempted not only to correct for redshift, but also correct for the missing slowly rising bursts, based on the assumption that the rise and the decay are independent, but that's not completely true. So you notice this isn't published yet. We're still messing around with it. And you have 3 different models here, cold dark matter, 2 star formation rate. Of course, that's obsolete as well. And, of course, the idea of a luminosity function is obsolete, or standard candle is obsolete. Here's what was suggested in Comers et al., and a function proportional to L to the minus 2.6. And here we're seeing a whole lot more apparent time dilation than what you should see. Now, if you turn around the other way and make the luminosity distribution increasing, it doesn't get any better. It just makes those 3 models lie on top of each other. And so we're measuring something more than what's there. There are 2 effects that I know about and I have to admit have been negligent. One of them cascades off the other. I never actually took into account, and we've been trying to get around to it for a while, that may make this look like it's more consistent with the prediction. And that is, I should have taken all these bright bursts and I should have been re-triggering them, putting the counts into the different detectors and dimming them down and seeing if they still triggered on each of these different brightness scales. Because that's what we do. We compare each one of these dimmed down, but we don't then decimate the sample. This is something that Bob said I should have done a long time ago. Never did. The reason was I didn't think that anything would be taken out. But it doesn't look like it agrees with theory. And so I started to think about it. These guys do have somewhat narrower pulses, and so they're not going to necessarily fill up the accumulation bins of the VATSI trigger. And so maybe the shorter of these will vanish, and then this fiducial comparison will make all these points come down, or maybe not. Maybe what we're measuring is still some further misunderstood or a factor. Maybe it's partially intrinsic. So it's a difficult game to play. I'm tired of playing it. Yeah. Okay. I said all that, so let me just skip to SGRs. Here's one of Kevin's view graphs. And it's just sort of hard to put SGRs on here, but they're peaking at around about 10 keV or so and dropping off somewhat like these black hole binaries, and also dropping off on the soft X-ray side. Entirely different than gamma ray bursts up there on the top. And of course, we've known where SGRs are for quite a while. They're inside supernova remnants. And we probably understand, other people will talk about this more, I'm sure. This you can ask Matthew Baring. He just got back from Australia. He's somewhere here in the audience. He's got a photon splitting model that explains that spectral peak and details I don't have time to go into. Let me just show you some of David Palmer's recent results. Here you see a map over time of the SGRs that have been active. Back in this time, three known SGRs were active, including 0526 minus 66, 1900 plus 14, and 1806 minus 20. Here you see the number of events per half month. 1806 was super active just there for several days, and then here's the period during which it was determined to be a magnetar, and here's some history here for 1914 becoming active again. So what Palmer did was go look at the old data from IC3. Here you see expanded twice, so that down on the bottom is just one day. Here in the middle is about 50 days. You see the activity of 1806. And what ought to have been apparent, and probably is a real effect, in my opinion, is that there were times here when there was roughly the same amount of energy being released during a period. And so you can see these slopes that are different, but practically coexisting on a time scale of days. And so during one of those intervals, the A interval, when the rate was fairly low, they've looked at this reservoir effect, similar to earthquakes. The earth can only take so much stress before it starts to give way. That, as I understand it, is this upper envelope here. And so bursts will, you know, take from that reservoir, and then the stress will build up again. And so the limiting case is that dashed pink line. And his conclusion, I think his general conclusion, the way to state it is, because that's not just one line, but fortunately, because these intervals are separated and not mixed together prevalently, you can see that there are different rates for interval A and interval B, different rates of counts being released per day. And so from that, he concluded that there are individual, independent relaxation areas on the surface of the star. Leave that guy behind and go to 1900 plus 14, the superburst, analogous to what we used to think of as the one and only March 5th event, but then another one went off. And here what you have is a change in binning. At this point onwards, it's more coarsely binned, but still actually looks better. Still, I think you can begin to see that there's something going on here in the envelope. It's obviously that Fourier composition is changing. Here's a blow up of the first part of the region there, going out to 10 or 12 or so cycles. And if you look very closely, you can see around in this region here, there's not too much variation from pulse 10 to pulse 20, about out here. But there is variation as you're coming down from the superburst itself. There's the binning change again. These spikes going down are just some kind of a strut getting in the way of the detector. By the way, these are all courtesy of Mazetz and Tom Klein. It's all unpublished data so far. And so here in three energy ranges across, and then going down, each of the different cycles unfolded. And the point is that during cycles about 10 to 20, the pulse phasing or the peaks there and their relative amplitudes are not changing terribly much. And so you can do an epic fold and see, if you look very closely, I think you can see all eight peaks that Dave is referring to here. 1, 2, 3, 4, a little shelf 5, 6, 7, and another little shelf 8. And the error bars are smaller than the widths of the curves there. And two energies, 15 to 50 and 50 to 200 keV. And so take those and put them onto an azimuthal plot and makes kind of interesting picture. And that's during bursts. And this is XTE non-burst pulse profile, which is different on a time scale of months. Here you're going from on the order of three peaks to just one peak. And I think just two final view graphs. A very interesting piece of information. There was another burst following on 2 days after that super burst. I call it a large burst on 98/08/29. And then there was one of the smaller SGR bursts that occurred during the super burst. That's just fascinating. And I don't think really that as much can be inferred of this from this graph as one might think. This is a phase on the ordinate in the lower plot versus time, and the bigger the symbol, the larger the burst. And the idea here is, and then I've colored the ones that are intermediate in intensity, so it's easy to separate. The idea is that there doesn't seem to be any correlation with phase. But what that says to me is probably what we've known for a while, is that there's a vast range in SGR intensities, and it doesn't matter that there's some phasing because there's such a range in intensity that it's multiplied by. Yeah, so this is the most fascinating point, excuse me, to me, that the two bursts can coexist. Okay.
I would like to make one comment. When you compare channel 4 and channel 1, I believe that you do this in counts.
Correct.
And counts in channel 1 are contributed by photons in channel 4, above 4, channel 3, channel 2. So the time lag which you are measuring and hardness ratio which you are measuring, you'll be very strongly influenced by the spectrum of photons. And a real physical feature you
yes.
would obtain if you will compare photons in channel 4, this photons in channel
yes. 4. Yes. In fact, the plots that I showed there for the six bursts, on the left, gamma to X ratio, on the right, total energy. On the right, only time dilation is taken out. In order to do what you say, we have to get down and dirty and look at 16 channel data in order to deconvolve the situation. Yeah.
Just one comment on the photon score. It's important not to let incorrect theoretical assumptions propagate too long. The effect of photon scoring is a change photon number in the magnitude of the very effective effect. And when photon scoring freezes out at sufficiently low temperatures, that will represent transition from a feed distribution. But only one mode is able to split at the energy spectrum that goes the soft component of the SGR burst. As a result, there is no cascade from dead energy to very low energy cascade.
Well, maybe you can debate that with Matthew because he thinks both modes split, so I'm no expert.
One other comment, it's something that was buried in my bucket with Duncan, and that is that splitting will convert the mode with low scattering cross section to the mode with high level scattering cross section outside the trapped, what we think is a trapped fireball. And As a result, that will induce a pipeline blood flow. Photons that matter together, photons that matter, and that can, I think, produce sort of collimated emission. So it appears to be almost these emissions that one observes in the extended tail of the R27 plus. Because we have a multiple structure to those surface magnetic fields and a number of open spots on the surface, then the couple of hydrogen beta hydrogen plus will along the field of the field line and give you more than one X-ray jet. But anyway, that's true.
You're going to talk about that next, right?
Last
night, I'm not going to talk about that. Save it all your time. Matthew, you want to say something about it?
Yeah.
Make it louder. Okay, I mean, we can discuss that after your talk if there's time. Maybe we can debate it, but let's direct some questions to what Jay has been talking about.
The 32 single pulse gamma ray burst that you showed the plot for was April 25th in the middle of the brightness distribution, fainter or brighter?
As I recall, it was in the middle. Yeah. I checked that though.
I was wondering in your time dilation versus peak flux plots, where would the observed redshift curves have fallen? Would they have more or less fitted in?
Right. I haven't checked that since a couple of them occurred. Yeah. They originally kind of worked, but I haven't checked it for a while.
Time for more questions. Do you guys agree about the nature of the time dilation?
Well, I think the nature of it is entirely in question.
No, I mean, the existence of
that. The measure, I think, in all studies so far, has not taken into account retriggering of bright bursts, which are at the fiducial timescale with which the others have to be compared. And so I think the best calibration is yet to be done.
So, from our side, we try to consider separately time spreading, which is a pure phenomenon, and time dilation, which is a cosmological effect of redshift and time dilation. And in our case, we are still not, as we consider, we are not still in very good agreement how similar or how different we see time stretching as a rise. We definitely conclude at this moment that stretching at rise from is not so visible like stretching at the back slope. And in the afternoon session, I will show you some of our results about it. But if we will compare the average profile, we will obtain about the same estimation which we presented.
Is it one more question? Is it, it would be say consistent to say that all the time dilation or stretching could be intrinsic and non-cosmological?
No, I guess I didn't emphasize that enough, that those models there have probed a large range in luminosity distribution possibilities as well as in star formation rates. I didn't even show the vaster range that we have probed. So, for instance, we have seen recently that star formation may just keep right on increasing. So we made it do that. Okay, and you still see approximately the same amount of expected measurable time dilation. So it has to be there, regardless of the luminosity distribution.
We have already, I believe, 6 or 7 redshift determinations. I wonder if anybody in the audience has either here or over internet data to make a plot intensity versus redshift for those 6 that is observed power, peak power. Earth per centimeter.
I've got
a number
for that.
Yeah. Versus retro. Just a pure no models.
Yeah, I have that. It looks funny.
That's what I'm saying.
That's my gun, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Almost looks like the flux doesn't seem to go down with redshift.
Yeah. The bright bursts are in the majority. Well, intrinsically bright bursts are in the majority.
That's why I raised the point. Because, yes, I mean, yes, if you put those 5 or 6 bursts we have redshift, either time dilation or log n, log s, or any of these diagrams, just everything is seems to be upside down. So I'm not sure whether we see any cosmological signature in any of the dispersion of the data that we have so far.
You have to take into account there's a difference between plotting 6 bursts for which you have redshifts and then the question of what's the average width of bursts or durations for a given brightness grouping. In order to see that effect, you need scores in each group.
This, if confirmed with lab statistics, has quite devastating consequences, I think, because your naive model for time stretching due to the source would be due to the beaming. But if we believe that the duration of the burst reflect on the lifetime of the source, then there should not be such a relation. It is only in the external shock model that we may expect dependence of duration on beaming angle. So I think it would be extremely interesting to get a few more redshifts. That would be quite devastating.
For many other reasons, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's stop here. Thank you, Jay. Let's thank you.